From Loretto to Williamsport, Mount Pleasant to Shamokin, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Better PA is a roadmap featuring a number of public policy initiatives, from everything to improve education to making Pennsylvania more competitive. Stephen Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation is joined by Rebecca Euler and Elizabeth Stell for a Capital Watch roundtable discussion. And generations of young Americans have been groomed by anti-American educational and cultural institutions to accept socialism. I'll have a town hall commentary on how that has fueled the rise of the Democratic Socialists. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Public schools across America have seen enrollment decrease by 1.4 million students since the COVID-19 pandemic. Despite the drop in enrollment, Reason Magazine reports public school funding increased by 34% between 2019 and 2024. Despite the significant increase in public spending on schools, there has been a decline in achievement across all subject areas and all grade levels. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled last spring that current sentencing guidelines for second-degree murder convicts are unconstitutional and gave the legislature a deadline for enacting new deadlines. The state Senate passed a bill in June doing just that, but State House Democrats made significant changes last week, thus missing the deadline for new guidelines to be in place. Law enforcement officials across the Commonwealth have decried the situation, with the Allegheny County District Attorney asking the High Court to extend the deadline. When State Senate Majority Leader Joe Scarnati retired a few years back, he endorsed then-DuBois City Manager John Herms Spluzio as his replacement. Then-State Representative Chris Dush defeated Spluzio in the primary battle. That's fortunate in that Spluzio pled guilty last week to money laundering and federal program theft during his time working with the city of DuBois. Back in 1976, then-Governor Milton Schaap ran for the Democratic presidential nomination. He finished behind no preference in the one primary in which he competed. The current Governor Shapiro is now running for his party's presidential nomination. He isn't polling much better. A recently released Emerson College poll ranks Josh Shapiro 7th among the possible Democrat contenders with just 5% support. Before he gets to that contest, however, Shapiro is trying to hold on to his current post, facing a challenge from Republican State Treasurer Stacey Garrity in the upcoming November general election. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The Commonwealth Foundation has developed a comprehensive set of policy proposals designed to make Pennsylvania a better place to live, work, and play. It's called Better PA, and our Capital Watch crew is here with the details. Stephen Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Elizabeth Stella of the Commonwealth Foundation. Stephen?
Welcome to Capital Watch, where we keep our eyes on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation, and I'm joined today by Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, and Liz Stell, Vice President of Policy at the Commonwealth Foundation. Dave Taylor is unable to be with us today. Welcome. Welcome, Rebecca. Great to see you again.
Great to see you, Steve. Good to be here.
And Liz, you're, I think, out representing your section of the Commonwealth out in the western counties?
Yes, it's nice to be joining you from the west today.
It's nice because it gives us a feel for the full Commonwealth-wide activities of our organization and the things we do all over Pennsylvania every day. In terms of setting the stage for today's show, I have a question basically. Are you tired of so much talk about the PA budget? And that goes for both Rebecca and Liz. Any thoughts on that idea that, are you getting sick of it? Like, we've talked about the budget a lot.
We do tend to talk about the budget a lot. That's true. It is a topic of discussion from February, from the time the governor gives his budget address, all the way through to the end of June, and sometimes in recent years, a lot later than that. So we are glad to be done talking about the budget for right now.
Liz, any budget gripes or praises?
I guess it's a good thing that they got the budget done in July instead of November, especially for folks who really depend on that state funding and have some of the unintended consequences of dragging that uncertainty out. Would have liked to see the spend number a little bit lower, but obviously we're in a divided government, so we have to compromise. So I think the name of the game now is let's focus on some really important issues that mean a lot to the people of Pennsylvania, because we still have quite a few months left before we close out the year and end the session. So let's get back to work.
Indeed, indeed.
You know, I just want to add, I was recently at a conference with other state trucking association executives, and we were talking about our legislative sessions. And it occurred to me, you know, a lot of states are in session like a couple of weeks a year. And that is not the case here in Pennsylvania. So it's kind of interesting to me how other states do this, in that here in Pennsylvania, we seem to be in session all year.
Some of those do it only every other year.
Every other year, right, right. So that is foreign to us here in Pennsylvania. We always have something to talk about here.
And it is. It's just a huge focus of what we do, because it's so important to the Commonwealth and the outcomes, as both of you mentioned. Like, these are serious questions, because there are resources being moved from taxpayers into these different entities and portions of the government that need to be funded. And that's a big deal, because it's stewardship. You're asking people to pay their taxes, and they're expecting essentially a fair return on that in terms of the growth of the Commonwealth and the success of our Commonwealth. I wanted to start out, Liz, with a couple of questions for you just on the history of the Better PA concept, and why did you decide to make the Better PA list, and what does Commonwealth Foundation need it?
Well, this started back in 2000 and really back in 2020, but we've been publishing it now for about 4 years, and it's the vision for Pennsylvania. A lot of times in politics, we get focused on talking about what we're against or why we don't like something, but it's really important to give people a picture of what good looks like, of what Pennsylvania could be, of what we're for. And so that's what Better Pennsylvania is. It's a plan of things to do. It's the type of policies that we know we need to have in place in order to make Pennsylvania attractive to workers and families, in order to have more economic freedom and just more prosperity across the board. So it's our hope and our vision. And I'm excited to say that every time we've put this out, we've been able to check a few boxes off of things that we've accomplished together, working with allies across the state. And I'm hopeful that we will be able to continue making that progress. But there's so many issues, and Better PA really just scratches the surface and says, what are the most important things that we can put in place in Pennsylvania today?
Can I ask a question, Liz? I'm curious, are these lists, I think it's a list of 30 policy ideas, which are really great. Are they based on things that have been successful in other states?
Yeah, some of it is best practices from other states, and some of it is ideas that we have produced at Commonwealth Foundation, you know, unique policy solutions that are customized for the specific challenges that Pennsylvania faces. I'll give you a couple of examples. Things like privatizing liquor and wine sales. Almost every other state has done that except for Utah. So that one's pretty tried and true. And that one, we think we can say definitively that one works. But something like Lifeline scholarships is pretty unique to Pennsylvania in terms of addressing our education needs. So it's a little bit of both, but we do try to take what's working well and apply it for the specific circumstances that Pennsylvania faces.
And have you heard, Liz, from other folks who just want to talk to you about some of the issues that they know are in the Better Pennsylvania agenda? Have folks outside of organization used it in ways that you're aware of?
Yeah, so it definitely helps us identify allies, because we will talk about these ideas and then we'll find out, you know, hey, so-and-so is working on this issue too. And then we're able to join together in advocating for it. So things like licensing reform, it helps build alliances across the state with other groups. Some of our energy work, it helps us clarify where we have common ground with different business partners. And I think the one thing that people find most surprising is that not all of these policies are, you know, Republican or conservative issues in the way they've typically been discussed. And that's really important to us at Commonwealth Foundation. We want to have the best policies for all Pennsylvanians. Wherever folks are willing to work with us to make those things a reality, those are our partners. And sometimes it doesn't always fall on the typical party lines.
And what do you, what in your mind is your special favorite policy? Because I know that you've been at Commonwealth Foundation for upward of a decade, and you are a renowned expert amongst your peers on these various policies that impact our state, but other states in our country as well. Is there one that you just feel like, this is a really great one, and I'd love to tell people about it or enlighten them about it?
Yeah, so I see, Steve, I think you probably anticipated this. The policy that is most dear and near to my heart are our welfare reform policies. So I think it's so important just to both protect those services for vulnerable Pennsylvanians, and also there's so much fraud and waste and abuse that's happening in those systems. So it's you know, driven, you know, I'm driven by both justice, but also, you know, compassion to really get these programs right. And so one of the things that's in the Better PA plan right now is requiring work requirements for able-bodied adults who are on Medicaid. So these are healthy people. They are low income, but they're healthy. So we're asking them to go and work a part-time job or even get education part-time or even community service part-time in order to maintain their access to taxpayer-funded healthcare benefits. And this has been something we've been trying to do at Commonwealth Foundation for almost a decade, and it is now a reality thanks to federal law. So it didn't come from the legislature, it came from Congress, but we're now beginning to implement it in Pennsylvania. And so that's one of the policies that we'll be able to at least check as started implementing. And I'm really excited to see that, because dignity and self-worth and so many things stem from good work and a sense of being needed. And I think that's really been robbed from so many Pennsylvanians. So I'm really excited to see this policy come into fruition and see, you know, the job participation go up and more resources able to flow to those folks who really do need support.
And this is one of the things that connects so well to the business environment here in Pennsylvania, too, because one of the things we talk about here on the show a lot is the inability of employers to find employees. And to the extent you can, you can incentivize and help people find job training and work opportunities that give them experience that they're able to get into the workforce, that's good from both sides. It's great for the employees, and it's good for the employers that are going to be able to find those employees eventually, too. So this is a win-win, I think.
And Rebecca, I wanted to ask you, too, why does Better PA matter to a sector like trucking, like the trucking industry that you represent? Or how does good policy help your members, those you serve? Or what kind of damage could bad public policy do versus having good, thought-out, well-formulated
sure.
policy?
Well, I'll just take this last example. We just talked about requiring work for able-bodied welfare recipients. We struggle in the trucking industry quite a bit with finding drivers and also diesel mechanics. In fact, Pennsylvania is one of the states that struggles more than other states to find diesel mechanics specifically. Everyone struggles to find drivers, but because we're such a trucking-heavy state, we have a lot of need for mechanics here in Pennsylvania, and that is the perfect job if you're able to connect a person with the right job training and a lot of grant programs that may be available for recipients to get into those types of training programs for diesel mechanics. They're excellent, good-paying jobs, family-sustaining jobs, making those connections between a low-income individual who's taking advantage of state funding now but can access those job training programs is a perfect way to get them into the job environment. So that's a great example of how that helps our industry. But overall, I mean, a lot of the policy issues in here are great for all industries, and trucking included. For instance, cutting regulatory red tape. One of the things our industry struggles with a lot is truck parking. Talked about that on the show. There's not enough parking spaces for truck drivers across the country. And one of the things I've heard is it's hard to build a truck parking facility because it's so hard to get permits to do so. So regulatory red tape, and you wouldn't necessarily connect regulations with truck parking, but it's absolutely true. If you need to get a water use permit for building a truck parking location, and sometimes you can't do it, or it might take a couple years and that funding opportunity's passed you by and you can't get the truck parking built. So that's another good example of where you might not connect the dots, but it absolutely makes a difference. So those are just two examples.
You're listening to Capital Watch. Liz, now that we've kind of figured out or learned about how Better PA came about and what it does. I wonder if you could start diving into a few of the specific policies that might be of interest to those listening.
So I will stay on the topic of regulation in particular, because I think that one is something that's been in the discussion a lot lately. It's something that our governor talks about, the need to cut the red tape to make sure we can build things here and attract the opportunities we need to keep people in Pennsylvania and thriving in Pennsylvania. And when we looked at Better PA, we said, okay, so how do we stack compared to other states? And we implement over 162,000 regulatory restrictions at last count, which puts us around 14th. In the country for the most red tape. Not all regulations are created equal. Some are much more onerous than others, but that gives you a rough ballpark figure. And so what we're looking at when we're talking about regulatory relief, red tape relief, it's not, you know, hey, you get a waiver, hey, you get a refund for this permit because we didn't get you an answer in time. It's broad-based, real relief and elimination. And so I think we need to, in Pennsylvania, push the conversation beyond just giving, you know, some waivers here and there, but actually reducing the amount of regs on the book, because so many, you know, aren't just duplicative or unnecessary. They can be outright harmful. And, you know, Rebecca gave a great example of things like parking, you know, so mundane, but so critical. And I'll just give listeners this picture in their minds that at last count, PA's regulatory restrictions amounted to over 10.5 million words. The Bible is only 783,000 words, round figure. So, like, okay, what are we doing here? Some of it's just we stack reg upon reg upon reg, and no one ever goes back to reassess. Does this still make sense? Technology is moving so fast, and yet we have no process for going back and reforming or revising our regulations. That touches, you know, not just on Rebecca's industry, but every industry in Pennsylvania. And when you can't build things, you can't do anything.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It really puts the brakes on developing and building anything in the state. And I know I've seen comparisons between you and businesses that have looked at building in surrounding states versus here. And we really do suffer from delays that are costs and delays caused by the regulatory burden you talked about, for sure.
Well, excellent. And Liz, what are some of the other ones that are perhaps particularly timely?
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit about education. We are coming up on that time of year again when people are thinking about back to school. I know my kids are already starting to make their requests for what they would like in terms of new clothes for the school year. And so on education, we have five policies in our Better PA plan. But the one I really want to highlight for folks actually isn't in the Better PA plan right now because it came about recently as a new opportunity. And that's something called the Federal Scholarship Tax Credit. And it's actually based on Pennsylvania's own Education Improvement Tax Credit, which is part of our Better PA plan. And it's this idea that you would be able to take tax credit of $1,700 beginning in tax year 27 and allocate that to scholarships for kids. And this could be a scholarship at a private school. It could be a scholarship for an after-school program, for a tutoring program. It could serve kids in a variety of ways to enhance and improve their education. It's a tremendous opportunity, but Pennsylvania can only take advantage of those tax dollars if the governor opts us in. And so far, Governor Shapiro has not opted us in. He has until the last day of 2026 to opt us in. And so we began asking the governor and drawing attention to this because it's so critical that these dollars are available to our students, because we believe strongly at Commonwealth of Nation that parents are in the best place to make education decisions for their kids. And they should have a choice in terms of the best school setting for their child. Too many kids in Pennsylvania today do not have a choice. In fact, the most recent data we have on our own tax credit program is that we turned away almost 70,000 applications, students who wanted to attend a private school but couldn't afford it and couldn't get a scholarship.
And that was strictly a monetary decision. That was not like those particular students hadn't measured up or they weren't showing some sort of promise. This is just kids who are ready and able to learn who were turned away because they don't have the funding.
Right, because we limit the amount of credits that are available. And so I will, you know, go a little bit back to the state budget and just say that there was an attempt to cut that program. even though tens of thousands of kids are being turned away, it's oversubscribed. And we fought that back very hard not to make sure that didn't happen. But now we need to go even further, right? Better PA is a vision of what can be, of what we want to say yes to. And we want to say yes to more EITC scholarships, yes to the federal scholarship tax credit.
Wow, really tragic, too. Just yeah. to think about the consequences, the situation in Pennsylvania's public schools is grim, and there are so many schools where there aren't any kids with the proficiencies that they're supposed to have at the age level they are at. And so we're seeing that struggle on and on, and this response is so vigorous to these opportunities because the kids are desperate. The families are desperate. They need a place where they can be at least at the competency level, let alone a place where they can really soar and start to learn subjects in the way that makes an impact on their lives in the future.
Absolutely. And Steve, I'll just, you know, reiterate, it's not a public versus private thing. All kids should have the choice of a variety of schools. You know, I know many families. One kid goes to a district, a public school. One kid goes to a cyber charter school. Maybe another kid goes to a private school. There's no right or wrong answer. The answer is just choice and empowering the family.
Excellent. We're getting close to the end of the show, and I just want to see if there's anything else, Liz, that a regulation or a policy proposal that is on the list here that you really think we should know about before we close the book on it, so to speak, for today.
Yeah, you know, I'll just point very quickly to two things we didn't really touch on much. We do have lots of recommendations in terms of what we call worker freedom, and that is addressing Pennsylvania's government unions. They do have a lot of special political privileges that make it really hard for workers to actually exercise their rights. So that's really critical. But the other thing that is maybe a little more timely in terms of news is energy policies. We know Pennsylvania is rich in natural resources, has a long heritage as being a leader in energy. And right now there are some really bad policies being thrown around the halls of Harrisburg. And what we have called for in Better PA is moving away from certain types of electricity taxes and mandates on what types of energy we can use, and instead instilling certain standards in terms of reliability for electricity grid and making sure that we have an even playing field so that we can build more generation and meet the demand, the surging demand that we're seeing right now, because we do have a comparative advantage in Pennsylvania. We've been building power plants for, you know, almost 100 years. We're really good at it. But too often, bad state policies are getting in the way.
It seems irresponsible not to take advantage of that advantage that we have. So that seems like a good idea.
And that's going to be all we have time for today. Liz and Rebecca, we want to thank you for being here. And I wonder where folks can find you and your organization on the web.
They can find the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association at pmta.org.
And Commonwealth Nation is commonwealthfoundation.org. You can also find us on Twitter or X at MyCommonwealth.
And you can also always find me at commonwealthfoundation.org. And for Rebecca and Liz, I'm Steve Bloom, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary by Loman Henry.
Sometimes, two seemingly unrelated developments are in fact cause and effect. Such is the case with the White House calling attention to the Smithsonian National Museum of American History's, quote, extreme political activism and the rise of militant socialism within the Democrat Party. The White House Domestic Policy Council issued a report in early July revealing the Smithsonian's exhibits treat history as a tool to divide citizens. The report pointed out the taxpayer-funded institution focuses, quote, too heavily on systemic flaws rather than on national achievements, end quote. Smithsonian officials naturally pushed back on the report, but the evidence proves the White House to be correct. For example, the Heritage Foundation's Mike Gonzalez, in an American Radio Journal interview, revealed the Smithsonian's exhibit on Benjamin Franklin suggested readers question whether Franklin performed electrical experiments on slaves. This, despite the fact there exists zero historical information suggesting the anti-slavery founding father did any such thing. Gonzalez testified last week before a congressional subcommittee investigating the White House allegations. He said during the radio interview, the Smithsonian's approach to gender and sexual identification issues was so perverse, he could not provide details on a family-oriented program. That, however, does not prevent the Smithsonian from placing such exhibits in areas frequented by families with small children. The big political story in recent weeks has been the rise of so-called democratic socialists within the ranks of the Democrat Party. Fueled by the election of extremist New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani, the socialist fringe of the party has racked up key victories in other cities, including Seattle and Washington, D.C., and scored primary victories in congressional races against establishment Democrats. The threat of more such wins by socialist candidates has roiled the Democrat Party, whose establishment wing appears unable to stem a drift, which has become a torrent, toward not only socialism, but communism. Radical views espoused by the Democratic Socialists of America have taken center stage, imperiling Democrat candidates in more moderate districts outside of urban cores. Among the reasons for this socialistic trend within the Democrat Party is the failure of establishment Democrats to stand for anything. Rather than offering a realistic set of policy alternatives, establishment Democrats have simply become anti-Trump. To a degree, that motivates the party's base, but younger voters in particular are looking for a path to a brighter future, and they have been seduced by the siren song of the Democrat socialists. Younger voters are vulnerable to falling for the socialist message because they have been groomed for decades by many of the nation's most influential institutions. The extreme political activism of the Smithsonian is the tip of the spear. The Smithsonian isn't just a museum. It provides course materials to schools across the country, spreading anti-American propaganda to young minds from sea to shining sea. Institutions of higher learning have for decades been bastions of left-wing indoctrination. That is why activists like Charlie Kirk, invading their campuses with facts and logic, pose such a threat. Rather than being forums for debate and the exploration of ideas, university campuses enforce rigid speech codes. Thus have several generations of young Americans been taught that socialism is a warm embrace, rather than an economic system that has failed everywhere it has been tried and resulted in brutal regimes responsible for the slaughter of millions of people. The left, of course, has no intention of moderating. During the House subcommittee hearing, Anthea Hartig, director of the National Museum of American History, bobbed and weaved, refusing to give straightforward answers to congressmen's questions. Left-wing media outlets immediately branded the hearing as modern-day McCarthyism. That, of course, is what the left always does when it must defend the indefensible, revert to name-calling. Hartig didn't give straight answers because her institution has been caught red-handed, pun intended, pushing a radical revisionist view of American history. This poses a dual threat: how to wean generations of young Americans off their acceptance of socialism and preventing the socialist surge within the Democrat Party from gaining enough traction it begins to influence national policy. Fortunately, there are countervailing trends, but the future of our republic depends on a large majority of our citizens understanding that capitalism has powered our economic successes and socialism will send us down the path to economic ruin and a loss of personal liberty. With a town hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 31 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WEDO-AM in White Oak, WPMG-FM in Danville, along with WEEU-AM in Reading, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.